had nothing to do with Ghosh that I must describe because it happened during that period. It explained Shiva's life course and why it veered away from mine. Late one morning, as Shiva and I sat on the culvert by the side of Missing's Hill, a frail, barefoot girl, no older than 12, came stiff-legged up the hill. Prematurely stooped like an old woman, she leaned heavily on her giant of a father. His muddy, patched jodhpurs ballooned above bare feet and horned toenails. He could have taken the hill in 20 strides. Instead, he took small steps to accommodate hers. They crept forward like snails, while other visitors sped up when they neared these two, as if father and daughter created an animating field. When she reached us, I understood why. An unspeakable scent of decay,
putrefaction,
and something else for which the words remained to be invented reached our nostrils. I saw no point in holding my breath or pinching my nose because the foulness invaded instantly, coloring our insides like a drop of India ink in a cup of water. In the way that children understand their own, we knew her to be innocent of a terrible, overpowering odor. It was of her, but it wasn't hers. Worse than the odor, since she must have lived with it for more than a few days, was to see in her face the knowledge of how it repulsed and revolted others. No wonder she had fallen out of the habit of looking at human faces. The world was lost to her, and she to it. When she paused to catch her breath, a slow puddle formed at her bare feet. Looking down the road, I could see the trail she left behind. I'll never forget her father's face. Under that peasant straw hat, he burned with love for his daughter and rage against the world that shunned her. His bloodshot eyes met every stare and even sought out those who tried not to look. He cursed their mothers and cursed the gods they worshipped. He was deranged by a scent he could have escaped. Did I say she met no one's gaze? No one's but Shiva's. A moment passed between them, a barely discernible easing of her features, as if Shiva had caressed her, reached out to comfort her.
His lifted chin dipped for her,
his eyes shaded to blue and his lips set firmly together. Her lids suddenly sparkled with liquid. The father who had blasphemed his way up the hill fell silent. My brother, who once spoke with anklets and whose dance could be as complex as a honeybee's, didn't know he would dedicate his life to just such women, the outcasts of society. He would seek them at the autobustera as they arrived from the provinces. He would pay touts to go to the furthermost villages and find them where they were hidden away, shunned by their husbands and families. He would have pamphlets distributed wherever the Coca-Cola truck went, which is to say, wherever there were paved roads, asking for these women, girls, really, to come out of hiding, to come to him, so that he might cure them. He would become the world's expert. But I am ahead of my story. Shiva's understanding of the medical condition behind that odor came later. That afternoon, one of many that I spent wondering about my future, Shiva had already sprung into action. With his eyes on her, he walked to them and led father and daughter to Hema. I look back now, and I realize that in that act, his career was already predetermined, and it was destined to differ vastly from mine. Chapter 23. The Afterbird and Other Animals. The rains had ended, and we had been back in class fewer than 2 weeks when Hema woke us with what I took to be good news.
"No school. We're keeping you home today," she said.
Something about trouble in the city. Taxis wouldn't be running. I stopped listening after no school. It was a perfect day to be home. Mescal celebrations were to start, and already Missing's fields were carpeted with yellow. We'd lose the soccer ball and the daisies. We'd climb into the treehouse. Then I remembered, with Gennett under Rosina's watchful eye, it wouldn't be the same. I pushed out the wooden shutters of my bedroom window and climbed onto the ledge. Sunshine flooded the room. By noon, the temperature would reach 75 degrees, but for the moment, I shivered in my bare feet. From my perch, I could see beyond Missing's east wall onto a quiet, meandering road which descended and then disappeared, the hills rising just beyond, as if the road had gone underground before it emerged in the distance as a mere thread. It wasn't a road we travelled or even one that I knew how to get to, and yet it was a view I felt I owned. On the left side, a fortress-like wall flanked the road, receding with it, struggling to stay vertical. Giant clusters of purple bougainvillea spilled over, brushing the white shamas of the few pedestrians. There was a quality to this pellucid first light and the vivid colors that made it impossible to imagine trouble. In the dining room, I noticed a strained, preoccupied expression on Ghosh's face. He had his shirt, tie, and coat on. He'd been awake for hours, it seemed. Hema, in her dressing gown, was huddled next to him, twisting and untwisting a lock of her hair. I was surprised to see Gennett there, her head jerked up when I came in, as if she didn't know I lived in the house. Rosina, who usually orchestrated our mornings, was nowhere to be seen. In the kitchen, I found Almaz frozen by the stove. Only when the egg began to smoke did she scoop it off the pan and onto my plate. I noticed the tears in her eyes. "The Emperor," she said when I pressed her. "How dare they do this to His Majesty? What thankless people! Don't they remember He saved us from the Italians? That He's God's chosen?" She told me what she knew. While the Emperor was on a state visit to Liberia, a group of Imperial bodyguard officers seized power during the night. They were led by our own Brigadier General Mebratu. "And Zamui? He is with them, of course," she said, whispering, shaking her head in disappointment. "Where is Rosina?" She pointed with her chin in the direction of the servants' quarters. Gennett came into the kitchen on her way to the back door. She looked frightened. I stopped her and held her hand. "Are you all right?" I noticed the gold chain and strange cross around her neck. She nodded, then went out the back door. Almaz didn't look at her. "It's true," Ghosh said, back in the dining room. He glanced at Hema, as if the two of them were trying to decide how much to divulge to us. What they couldn't hide was their anxiety. The previous evening, General Mebratu went to the Crown Prince's residence to tell him that others were plotting a coup against his father. At the General's urging, the Crown Prince summoned ministers loyal to the Emperor. When they came, General Mebratu arrested them all. It was a brilliant ploy, but it unsettled me. I couldn't imagine Ethiopia without Haile Selassie at the helm. Nobody could. The country and the man seemed to go together. General Mebratu was our hero, a dashing figure who could do no wrong. The Emperor had lost some of his glow for us, but I never expected this of the General. Was this a betrayal, a dark side of his that had emerged, or was he doing the right thing? "How do you know all of this?" I asked. One of the prisoners, an old and frail minister, had had an asthma attack, and so Ghosh had been summoned to the Crown Prince's residence in the early morning. "The General doesn't want anyone dying if he can help it. He wants it to be peaceful." "Does he want to be emperor?" I asked. Ghosh shook his head. "No, I don't think that's it at all. What he wants is for the poor to have food, to have land. That means taking it from the royals and from the church." "So, is this a good thing he is doing, or a bad thing?" Shiva asked, looking up from the book he had brought to the table. That was Shiva. He hated ambiguity and he wanted things cut and dried. Often when Shiva asked such a question, it was because he didn't see what was obvious to me. But in this case, it was a good question. One that I wanted to ask too.
Isn't the imperial bodyguard supposed to defend the emperor? Shiva added.
Ghosh winced, as if Shiva's query hurt.
This isn't my country, so who am I to judge? Mebratu has a good life. He didn't have to do this. I do think he's doing this for the people. Long ago he was under great suspicion. Then he was the favorite son. And recently he was under suspicion again, and he felt he might be arrested very soon anyway.
Ghosh said that as he left the Crown Prince's palace. Zemui had walked Ghosh to his car and given Ghosh something to give to Genet. It was the gold pendant Darwin Easton had taken off his own neck and given to Zemui, the St. Bridget's cross. He'd asked Ghosh to convey his love to her and to Rosina. After Hema dressed, she and Ghosh left for the hospital.
Stay close to home, boys, you hear?
We were not to leave missing property, no matter what. I went to the gate. I met just three patients coming up the hill. No car or bus passed by missing. I stood with Gibru, staring out. The silence was eerie. Not even the clip-clop of horseshoes or the jingle of harness bells to break the stillness.
When the four-legged taxis stay in their stables, you know things are serious, Gibru said.
There were bars, a tailor's shop, and a radio repair shop in the two cinder block buildings across from us. But there was no sign of life. Ignoring Hema and Ghosh's warnings, and over Gibru's protests, I crossed the road to the tiny Arab souk, a plywood structure painted canary yellow that sat between the larger buildings. The window through which the souk usually conducted business was shuttered, but a child emerged through the door, which was barely cracked open, carrying a cone-shaped package made out of newspaper and wrapped in twine. Probably 10 cents worth of sugar for the morning tea. I slipped in. The air inside was thick with incense. If I leaned over the counter, I could touch the back wall. The Arab souks all over Addis were like this, as if they'd come from the same womb. Dangling down from the ceiling, on clothespins attached to a string, were single-use packets of Tide, Bayer aspirin, chiclets, and paracetamol. They twirled like party decorations. A meat hook hanging from the rafters held squares of newspaper, ready to use as wrapping. A roll of twine hung on another hook. Loose cigarettes sat in a jar on top of the counter, unopened cigarette packs stacked next to them. The shelves were stuffed with matchboxes, bottled sodas, big pens, pencil sharpeners, Vicks, Nivea cream, notebooks, erasers, ink, candles, batteries, Coca-Cola, Fanta, Pepsi, sugar, tea, rice, bread, cooking oil, and much more. Mason jars full of caramella and cookies flanked the counter, leaving an opening in the middle over which I leaned. I saw Ali Osman, lace cap glued to his head, seated on the mat along with his wife, infant daughter, and two men. The floor space was hardly big enough for Ali and his family to sleep spooned against one another, knees bent, and now he had visitors. They sat around a pile of cot. Ali was worried.
Marian, times like this are when foreigners like us can suffer, he said.
It was strange to hear him use the word Ferengi to describe himself, or me, because we were both born in this land. I crossed back over to Gibru and shared with him some stick candy I had bought. Suddenly, Rosina walked right past us.
Look after Genet,
she called over her shoulder. I didn't know whether she meant me or Gibru.
Wait,
Gibru said, but she didn't. I ran after her and grabbed her hand.
Wait, Rosina, where are you going? please.
She spun on me as if to tell me off, but then her face softened. She was pale, and her eyes were puffy from crying. The skin was tight over her jaw, whether in fear or determination, I couldn't tell.
The boy is right. Don't go, Gibru said. What would you have me do, priest? I haven't seen Zumui in a week. He's a simple fellow. I'm worried for him. He'll listen to me. I'll tell him he must be loyal to God and the Emperor before anything else.
I was suddenly scared. I clung to Rosina. She pulled herself free, but gently. Out of habit, she pinched me on the cheek and ran her hand through my hair. She kissed me on the top of my head.
Be reasonable, Gibru said. The Imperial Bodyguard headquarters is too far away. If he's with the general, then he's in the palace. You'll be walking right past the army headquarters and the 6th police station. It will take you too long.
With a wave, she was gone. Gibru, whose eyes were perpetually weepy from trachoma, looked as if he might bawl. He perceived a danger far greater than anything I could imagine. 10 minutes later, a jeep with a mounted machine gun appeared, followed by an armored car. They were Imperial Bodyguard soldiers, wearing grim expressions and also combat helmets in place of their usual pith helmets. Camouflage fatigues and ammo belts had replaced the regular olive-green drill. A voice came over a loudspeaker mounted on the armored truck.
People, remain calm! His Majesty Crown Prince Asfar Wosin has taken over the government. He will be making an announcement at noon today. Listen to Radio Addis Ababa at noon. Radio Addis at noon. People, remain calm.
I wandered away from the gate and drifted over to the hospital. W.W. Gonad was sitting in the breezeway outside the blood bank, a transistor radio in his lap, and nurses and probationers sitting close to him. He looked excited, happy. At noon in our bungalow, we gathered around the Grundig and Rosina's transistor radio. One turned to the BBC and the second to Radio Addis Ababa. Almaz stood to one side. Kenneth shared a chair with me. Hema took the clock down from the mantelpiece and wound it. The unguarded expression on her face showed the depth of her anxiety. Matron seemed the least concerned, blowing on a cup of dark coffee, smiling at me. A faceless, stentorian English voice said,
"This is the BBC World Service."
At last, the announcer moved from a coal-stricken Britain to what interested us.
"Reports from Addis Ababa, the capital of Ethiopia, indicate that a bloodless coup has taken place while Emperor Haile Selassie was away on a state visit to Liberia. The Emperor has cut short his visit and abandoned his plans for a state visit to Brazil."
Coup was a new word for me. It implied something ancient and elegant, and yet the adjective bloodless implied that there had to be a bloody variety. I confess that at that moment, I was thrilled to hear our city, and even the Imperial Bodyguard, mentioned by the BBC. The British knew nothing of missing, or the view of the road from my window. But now, we'd made them look in our direction. Years later, when Idi Amin said and did outrageous things, I understood that his motivation was to rattle the good people of Greenwich Mean Time, have them raise their heads from their tea and scones and say, "Oh yes, Africa." For a fleeting moment, they'd have the same awareness of us that we had of them. But how was it that the BBC could look out from London and see what was happening to us? When we looked over the walls of missing, we saw nothing. Well, afternoon, and long after the BBC broadcast, the martial music on Radio Addis Ababa ceased, and, with a rustle of papers, a stuttering Crown Prince Asfar Wosin came on the air. What little I had seen of the portly, pale eldest son in the newspaper and in the flesh suggested a man who might scream at the sight of a mouse. He lacked the emperor's charisma and bearing. The crown prince read a statement, and it was clear he was reading, in the high Amharic of officialdom, difficult for anyone but Almaz and Gebru to understand. When he was done, Almaz left the dining room, upset. Minutes later, how did they do this? The BBC aired a translation. The people of Ethiopia have waited for the day when poverty and backwardness would cease to be, but nothing has been achieved. The crown prince said his father had failed the country. It was time for new leadership. A new day was dawning. Long live Ethiopia.
Those are General Mebrattu's words, Ghosh said.
More like his brother's, Hema said. They must have a gun to the crown prince's head, Matron said. I don't hear any conviction in his voice.
Well then, he should have refused to read it, I said. Everyone turned to look at me. Even Shiva lifted his head up from the book he was reading.
He should say, no, I won't read it. I would rather die than betray my father.
Marion's right, Matron said at last. It doesn't say much about the crown prince's character.
It's just a ploy, using the crown prince, Ghosh said. They don't want to dump the monarchy right away. They want the public to get used to the idea of a change. Did you see how upset Almaz is at the idea of someone deposing the emperor?
Why do they care about the public? They have the guns, the power, Hema said.
They care about a civil war, Ghosh said. The peasants worship the emperor. Don't forget the territorial army, all those aging fighters who battled the Italians. Those irregulars are neither army nor bodyguard, but they far outnumber them. They can come pouring into town.
They might anyway, Matron said.
Mebrattu couldn't get the army, police or air force's support ahead of time, Ghosh said. I suppose the more people he involved before the coup, the more likely he'd have been betrayed. The general and his brother, Eskinder, were arguing when I got there this morning. Eskinder had wanted to trap all the army generals the previous night, using the same ruse that had trapped the other loyalists. But the general vetoed that.
You saw the general when you went there? I asked.
I wish he hadn't, Hema said. He has no business getting in the middle of this, she said, looking cross.
Ghosh sighed. I went as a physician, Hema, I told you. When I got there, Sigwe Debu, the head of the police, had thrown in his lot with Mebrattu. He and Eskinder were pressing the general to attack the army headquarters before the army can get organized. But he refused. He was emotional. These were his friends, his peers. He was sure that good men in the other services would throw their lot in with him. You know, he took the time to see me to the door. He thanked me. He told me he was determined to avoid bloodshed.
The rest of the day went by with the streets eerily silent. Very few patients came to Missing. And patients who could leave fled for home. We sat glued to the radio. Genet stayed in her quarters alone. In the late afternoon, Hema sent me to fetch her. I led her back by the hand. She put on a brave front, but I knew she was worried and scared. That night, she slept on our sofa. There was no sign of Rosina. The next day, the city was so quiet, the only thing circulating was rumors. Only the bravest of shopkeepers opened his doors. Word was that the army was still wavering, undecided about whether to support the coup leaders or remain loyal to the emperor. At noon, Gebru came to tell us that we should go to the gate. We got there in time to see a huge procession of university students carrying Ethiopian flags, their faces glowing with sweat and excitement. They were grouped under banners, College of Arts and Sciences, College of Engineering. Marshals with armbands kept order. To my amazement, there was W.W. Gonad marching under the banner of the School of Business. He gave us a sheepish grin, adjusted his tie, and marched on, trying to look like a member of the faculty. There must have been several thousand students and staff, and they chanted in one voice in Amharic, "My countrymen, awake! History calls you! No more slavery! Let freedom reign anew!" Banners in English read, "For everyone, a bloodless revolution," and "Let us stand peacefully with the new government of the people." The street was lined with wary onlookers who, like us, had been indoors much too long. Stray dogs gathered, barking at the marchers and adding to the noise. A pretty student in jeans put leaflets in our hands. Almaz pushed the paper away as if it were contaminated. "Hey, miss, is this why they sent you to university?" Almaz called after her. An old man with a beard waved his fly swatter as if he were trying to smack the students. "If you were studying, you shouldn't have time for this," he shouted. "Don't forget who built your university, who taught you to read." We learned later from W.W. Gonad that in the Mercato, the Muslims and Eritrean shopkeepers received the students with cheers. But elsewhere in Addis, their reception by the public was cold, and when the procession turned to reach the army headquarters, where they had intended to convince the army to join the revolt, they were met at an intersection by an army platoon in combat gear. The young commander told the crowd that they had exactly 1 minute to disperse, or he would give his soldiers orders to fire. The students tried to argue, but the sounds of rifle bolts pulling back convinced the marchers to retreat. That was when W.W. Gonad left the rally. I was still pleased to be out of school, but the anxiety of the faces of the adults had rubbed off. Ghosh and Matron returned to the hospital to prepare for casualties. Hema had her version clinic that afternoon. Shiva, who till then had little interest in what was going on, was uneasy, as if he sensed something no one else did. Unusual for Shiva, he asked Hema if she would stay home and not go to work. "I don't want to leave, my love," she said, agonizing over what to do. "But I have version clinic." "Take us with you," Shiva said. Then he added, "We practiced Bikram. See my paper, just as you told us." His calligraphy was better than the examples of the ornate and round style in the book. "So please?" "I really can't," Hema said. "I have to go to the labor room first before clinic." "We'll go with you," Shiva said. "No, I won't have you in the labor room." She could see the disappointment in Shiva's face. "I tell you what, you boys go to the version clinic and wait for me. Whatever you do, stay together." This was the rarest of invitations. Unlike Ghosh, if Hema carried a stethoscope, she didn't bring it home. The white coat we glimpsed her wearing in the hospital stayed there. I rarely thought of Hema as a doctor because at home she was all mother. Ghosh constantly talked medicine, but Hema never did. We knew she went to labor and delivery and that she operated on Mondays and Wednesdays. From what we overheard, she was very good and in great demand, but the specifics were not mentionable to us. She wanted us to always know that her eyes were on us, and no doctoring would distract her from that vigilance. The version clinic was a good example. We'd heard of it for years, but we hadn't the least idea what went on there. According to the dictionary, one meaning of version was from the Latin versus, to turn. Hema's departures in the night came with cryptic phrases, words stranger than version, tossed over her shoulder. Eclampsia, or postpartum hemorrhage, or, that most chilling term of all, the delayed afterbirth. That one wasn't even in the medical dictionary. and you never heard of the afterbird except when it was delayed. It was feared, and yet its arrival was necessary. Shiva and I looked for that delayed afterbird on the trees of Missing, or high up in the sky. Shiva drew the afterbird, and in his many renderings it was like a flying wing, an elongated triangle, sightless, legless, but beautiful, sleek, aerodynamic, and utterly mysterious. Could our mother's death be linked to the delayed afterbird? It would have been so easy to ask Hema, but the topic was off limits. At least, that was how Hema made it feel. The women's clinic behind the main hospital building deviated from the whitewashed decor of Missing, because it had lime green paint on the outer walls and blue banisters. A hygienia tree dropped orange blossoms on the steps. The soil underneath the tree was aflame with blue lobelia and pink clover. We found a gaggle of pregnant patients seated on the steps, their hair covered by sashes. While waiting, they tucked fresh blossoms behind their ears and stretched their legs out in front of them. Their white shamas glowed in the sun, and with bellies swollen, clutching their pink outpatient cards, they resembled a flock of lively geese. Some were barefoot, and those who weren't had eased off their plastic shoes. It was tense in the city, but looking at these women and hearing their laughter, their complaints about swollen ankles, husbands, or heartburn, you would never have known. When they spotted us, they called us over to shake our hands, ask our names, our age, fuss with our hair, and remark on our similarity. They insisted that we sit with them, and I would have declined, except Shiva happily said yes. I sat there, embarrassed, like a chick squished between hens. Shiva seemed to be in heaven. So often we never truly see our own family, and it is for others to tell us that they've grown taller or older. I confess, I mostly took Shiva's appearance for granted. He was my twin, after all. But at that moment, I was seeing my brother anew. The large, rounded forehead, the curls that piled up on his head, threatening to fall forward and obscure his sight. The equanimity around the brow and eyes, and his mannerism of putting his finger alongside his cheek, just like the Nehru portrait on our wall at home. What was completely new was this smile which transformed my roommate into a blue-eyed stranger, rendering a lightness to his being, so that were it not for the sturdy female arms draped over his shoulders, caressing his hair, he would have floated off those steps. A woman read a pink pamphlet that had been dropped over the piazza in Mercato by an Air Force plane. She was the lone woman who could read, albeit slowly. "Message from His Holiness, Patriarch of the Church, Abuna Basilios," she said, and heads at once bowed, and hands made the sign of the cross, as if His Holiness were on the steps with them. "To my children, the Christians of Ethiopia, and to the entire Ethiopian people. Yesterday, at about 10 in the evening, the Imperial Bodyguard soldiers, who were entrusted with the safety and welfare of the royal family, committed crimes of treachery against their country." Seated in their midst, sweating in the sun, I shivered. I could see that the patriarch's words rang true for these ladies. He was speaking for God. This did not bode well for the man we so admired, General Mebratu. The women turned naughty after that, mocking the bodyguard and then men in general, laughing and carrying on as if they were at a wedding. Shiva was in rapture, grinning from ear to ear. His earlier apprehension had vanished. It was as if he'd found his ideal spot, surrounded by pregnant women. There was much about my brother I did not understand. When Hema appeared, the women struggled to their feet, despite Hema's protests. A mother's pride showed in Hema's eyes to see us adopted by her patients. Three at a time, the women mounted the examining tables. They pushed their skirts down just below their bellies and pulled their chemises up to expose their watermelon swellings. When one of the patients on the table waved to Shiva to come close and hold her hand, he stepped in and I followed. Hema bit her tongue.
All late third trimester,
Hema said after a while without explaining what that meant. She used both hands to confirm that the baby's position was
something other than head down. A baby can't come out easily unless its head is pointing down to the mother's feet. That is why the prenatal clinic sent them here to Virgin Clinic, she said,
mentioning another clinic which we knew she attended in this very room, but on a different day. She pulled out a strange, stunted version of a stethoscope, a fetoscope. The bell of the stethoscope had a U-shaped metal bracket on which she could rest her forehead and then use the weight of her head to press the bell into the skin, leaving her hands free to stabilize the belly. She held up a finger like a conductor signaling for quiet. Conversation stopped, and the patients on the stretchers and the throng around the door held their breaths, till Hema raised up and said,
"Galloping like a stallion!"
A score of voices added, "Praise the saints!" Hema didn't offer to let us listen. She got down to business. "With this hand, I cup the baby's head. My other hand, I put here where the baby's bottom is. How do I know?" She looked at Shiva as if his question was impertinent. Then she laughed.
"Do you know how many thousands of babies I felt this way, my son?
I don't have to think. The head is this coconut-like hardness. The bottom is softer, not as distinct.
My hands give me a picture," she said, outlining a shape in the air above the exposed belly. "The baby's back is to me. Now watch."
She set her feet, then using firm and steady pressure of her cupped hands, she pushed the head one way, the butt the other way, while also pushing her hands toward each other as if to keep the baby curled up. Something in the way her thumbs were aligned with the rest of her fingers, all held close together, reminded me of her Bharatanatyam dance gestures.
"There, you see? An initial resistance, a stickiness. Then it gives, and the baby tumbles over."
I saw nothing.
"Well, of course you didn't see. The baby's floating in water. Once I start the turn, the baby finishes the last quarter turn by itself. Now it's not a breech baby. It's a head presentation. Normal."
She listened to the fetal heart again to be sure it was still strong. In no time, Hema, possessed of the same bustling energy with which she dealt cards or drilled us on our spelling, was done. Only one baby refused to somersault.
"For all I know, this clinic could be the biggest waste of time. Ghosh wants me to do a study to see how many babies float back to where they were after version. You know how he talks. The unexamined practice is not worth practicing."
She snorted, remembering something else.
"I had a friend when I was a child, a neighbor boy by the name of Vilu. He kept chickens. Now and then a hen would cluck in a peculiar way, and Vilu knew, don't ask me how, that it meant an egg was stuck in a transverse position. He would reach in and turn it vertical. The chicken stopped clucking and the egg would pop out. Vilu was obnoxious at your age, but I remember his trick with the chicken now, and I wonder if I underestimated him."
I didn't say a word for fear of breaking the spell. It was so rare to hear her think aloud like this.
"Between you and me, boys, I have no desire to publish a paper that might put me out of this business. I enjoy Virgin Clinic."
"Me too," Shiva said.
"Whether it is India or here, the ladies are all the same,"
Hema said, gazing at the women milling around. No one had left. They waited for the tea, bread, and vitamin pill that would follow the clinic. They grinned back at Hema with sisterly affection. No, with adoration.
"Look at them. All happy and radiant. In a few weeks, when labor starts, they'll be yelling, screaming, cursing their husbands.
They'll turn into she-devils. You won't recognize them. But now they're like angels. She sighed. A woman is never more a woman than in this state. The problems of the city and the country had disappeared, at least for me and Shiva. How fortunate we were to have Hema and Ghosh as parents. What was there to fear? Ma, Shiva said, Ghosh says pregnancy is a sexually transmitted disease. He says it knowing you'll repeat it to me, that rascal. He shouldn't be telling you such things. Can you show us where the baby comes out? Shiva said. I knew he was utterly serious, and I also knew that with those words he'd broken the spell. I was furious with him. Kids need a certain cunning when it comes to dealing with adults, and somehow Shiva had none. In the same mysterious fashion with which permanent teeth arrived, so also self-consciousness and embarrassment came to camouflage my guilt, while shame took root in my body as a price for curiosity. Okay, that's enough. Time for you chaps to go home, Hema said. Ma, what does the word sexual mean? Shiva said, as she pushed us out. I studied my twin. For once, I was unsure of his intent. Was he teasing her, or was this just his unconventional way of thinking? Hema's response only added to my confusion. I have to go to the wards for a short time. You boys don't leave the house. She shooed us off. Her tone was annoyed, and yet, if I was not mistaken, she was trying very hard to hide a smile. Chapter 24 Loving the Dying. In a country where you cannot describe the beauty of the land without using the word sky, the sight of three jets streaking up in a steep climb was breathtaking. I happened to be outside on the front lawn. The shockwave traveled through the earth to my feet and ran up my spine before I heard the explosion. I stood rooted there. Smoke rose in the distance. The stunned silence that followed was shattered by the screech of hundreds of birds, which took to the sky, and by the barking of every dog in the city. I still wanted to believe that this, the jets, the bombs, was all part of some grand plan, the expected course of events, and that Hema and Ghosh understood what was going on, even if I didn't. Whatever this was, they could turn it around. When Ghosh emerged from the house, running as fast as he could, and when he grabbed me, fear and concern in his eyes, the last of my illusions vanished. The adults weren't in charge. There were clues to that earlier, I suppose, but even when I had seen the old woman pummeled by the Emperor's guards, it suited me to believe that Hema and Ghosh still controlled the universe. But fixing this was beyond their ability. Ghosh, Hema, and Almaz dragged mattresses into the corridor. Our whitewashed chikka walls, packed mud and straw, offered little protection. In the corridor, the bullets would at least have to pass through two or three chikka walls. Bullets whined overhead, sounding close, while the pops and thuds sounded distant. Glass tinkled in the kitchen, and later we found a bullet had shattered a pane. I lay on the mattress, frozen, my body incapable of movement. I waited for someone to say, "This is a colossal error that will soon be corrected and you can go out and play again." "I suppose we can assume the army and air force decided not to join the coup," Ghosh said, looking to see if this understatement got a response from Hema. It did. Genet's lips were quivering. I could only imagine how worried she was. I felt a cold flutter in my belly whenever I thought about Rosina, gone for more than 24 hours now. I reached out, and Genet clutched my hand. By dusk, the firing intensified, and it turned bitterly cold. Matron, fearless, went back and forth to the hospital, despite our pleas that she stay. When I had to go to the bathroom, I crawled.
I saw through the window the bright tracers crisscrossing the sky. Gibru locked and chained the main gate and withdrew from his sentry hut to the main hospital complex. The nurses and nursing students were bedded down in the nurses' dining room with W.W. Gonad, as well as Adam, the hospital compounder, watching over them. Near midnight, there was a knock at our back door, and when Ghosh opened it, there stood Rosina. Gennet, Shiva, and I swarmed all over her, hugging her. Through hot tears, Gennet screamed at her mother in Tigrinya for leaving her and making her worry. Matron stood grinning just behind Rosina. Some instinct had made Matron and Gibru go down to the lock gate to check one last time. Huddled against it, they found Rosina, sheltering from the wind. As she gobbled down food, Rosina told us that things were much worse than she'd imagined.
I wanted to reach the upper part of town, but there was an army roadblock. I had to take the big detour, first this way, then that.
A firefight around a villa forced her to take cover. And then army tanks and armored vehicles prevented her return. She spent the night on the porch of a shop at the Mercato, where others, trapped by darkness, had taken shelter. In the morning, she'd been unable to move from the Mercato because of roaming army platoons who ordered everyone off the street. It had taken her till nightfall to cover a distance of 3 miles. She confirmed our worst fears. The Imperial bodyguard was under attack by the army, air force, and police. Pitched battles were being fought all over, but the army was steadily concentrating its efforts on General Mebratu's position. Rosina snuck off to her quarters to wash and change clothes, and she returned with her mattress and also with Caramella for us. Gennet still hadn't forgiven her, but she clung to her. Matron sank down on the mattress and stretched out her feet. She reached under her sweater and pulled out a revolver, tucking it between mattress and wall.
Matron,
Hema said.
I know, Hema. I didn't buy this with the Baptist money, if that is what you are thinking. That's not what I was thinking at all,
Hema said, looking at the gun as if it might explode.
I promise you, this was a gift. I keep it in a place where no soul could find it. But you see, looters, that's what we need to worry about,
Matron said.
This might stop them. I did buy 2 other guns. I've passed them out to W.W. Gonad and Adam.
Almaz carried in a basket of injera and lamb curry. We ate with our fingers from this communal dish. Then it was back to waiting, listening to the crackles and pops in the distance. I was too tense to read or do anything but lie there. Shiva sat cross-legged. He carefully folded a sheet of paper, then tore it in half and then repeated the process again and again till he had a bunch of tiny squares. I knew he was just as shaken as I was by the turn of events. Watching his hands moving methodically, I felt as if I were keeping my mind and my hands busy. Now he put 1 paper square by itself, then counted and stacked 3 squares next to it, then 7, then 11. I had to ask.
Prime numbers,
he said, as if that explained anything. He rocked back and forth, his lips moving. I marveled at his gift for distancing himself from what was going on by dancing or by drawing the motorcycle or playing with prime numbers. He had so many ways of climbing into the treehouse in his head, escaping the madness below and pulling the ladder up behind him. I was envious. But Shiva's escape was incomplete tonight. I knew because in watching him, I felt no relief.
Don't try, I said to Shiva. Let's go to sleep.
He put his papers away at once.
Rosina and Gennet were already fast asleep, both exhausted.
Rosina's return was a great reprieve, But my greatest relief that night came when my head touched Shiva's. A sense of safety and completion. A home at the end of the world. Thank God that whatever happened, we'd always have Shiva Marion to fall back on, I thought. Surely we could always summon Shiva Marion when we needed to, though I guiltily remembered that we hadn't done so in a while. I nudged his ribs, and he nudged back, and I could feel him smile without opening his eyes. I took reassurance from that, because earlier that day he'd been a stranger sitting on the Virgin Clinic steps. But now he was Shiva again. Together we had an unfair advantage on the rest of the world. I awoke at some point to find everyone but Matron and Ghosh asleep. The gunfire came in intense bursts, but with unpredictable moments of quiet, so that I could hear Matron clearly as she spoke to Ghosh. When the Emperor fled Addis in 36, just before the Italians marched in, it was chaos. I should have gone to the British legation. One look at the Sikh infantrymen at the gate, with their turbans and beards and bayonets, and no looter was going to get near. Biggest mistake I made was not to go there.
Why didn't you?
Embarrassment. I dined once with the ambassador and his wife. I felt so out of place. Thank God for John Melly. He was a young missionary doctor. He sat next to me. He talked about his faith and his hopes to build a medical school here. Her voice trailed off.
You told me about him once, Ghosh said. You loved him. You said one day you'd tell me all about it.
There was a long silence. I was tempted to open my eyes, but I knew that would break the spell. Matron's voice sounded thick. By staying here, I was responsible for John Melly's death. It wasn't missing hospital then. Surely a hospital will be spared, is what I thought anyway. But our own ward boy led a mob here. They snatched a young nursing assistant and raped her. I fled to the other end of the infirmary, where I found Dr. Sorkis, you never met him, a Hungarian, a terrible surgeon, a morose fellow. He operated like a technician, disinterested. We'd had such a parade of short-time doctors till you and Hamer and Stone arrived. She sighed again. On that night, though, Sorkis made all the difference in the world. He had a shotgun and a pistol. When the mob reached the infirmary, I pleaded through the closed door with Tesfaye. That was the ward boy's name. Don't be part of this evil for the sake of God. Oh, but he mocked me. There is no God, Matron, he said. Said many other vile things. When they broke down a panel on the door, Dr. Sorkis fired first one barrel at eye level and the second barrel at groin level. The sound deafened me. When my hearing came back, I heard men screaming in pain. Sorkis reloaded and went outside, firing the shotgun at knee level. I confess, I felt pleasure to see them hobble away. Instead of fear, I felt anger. Tesfaye came charging again. I think he thought the rabble was still with him. Sorkis raised his pistol, this very one here, and he squeezed the trigger. Even before I heard the sound, I saw Tesfaye's teeth spray out and the back of his head pop. The fight went out of the rest. When the Italians marched into town the next morning, call me a traitor, Ghosh, but I for one welcomed them because the looting stopped. That's when I discovered that John Melly had tried to get me to safety. He stopped his truck to help a wounded man, and when he did, a drunken looter came right up to him and fired a pistol into Melly's chest, for no reason at all. I hurried to the legation when I heard. I nursed him round the clock. He suffered for 2 weeks, but his faith never wavered. It is one reason I never left Ethiopia. I felt I owed it to him. He'd asked me to sing Bunyan's hymn to him while I held his hand. I must have sung it 1,000 times before he died. He who would valiant be gainst all disaster, let him in constancy follow the master. There's no discouragement shall make him once relent his first avowed intent to be a pilgrim. What incredible discoveries one could make with one's eyes closed. I'd never heard Matron talk, let alone sing, about her past. In my mind, it was as if she'd arrived into the world fully formed, in nun's garb, always running missing. Her whispered tale, her confession of her fear, of love, of a killing, were more frightening than the gunfire in the distance. In that dark corridor, lit only by the intermittent glow of flares and artillery traces which made dancing shadows on the wall, I pressed hard against Shiva's skull. What else did I not know? I wanted to sleep, but Matron's hymn, her quavering voice, still echoed in my ears. Chapter 25. Anger as a Form of Love. By the next evening, it was all over. The coup had failed. In 3 days, hundreds of Imperial bodyguard soldiers had been killed, and many more had surrendered. I saw one man being dragged out of the cinder block building across from Missing. He tried to get rid of his distinctive uniform, but the fact that he was wearing just a vest and boxers identified him as a rebel. As the army tanks and armored cars closed in, General Mebratu and a small contingent of his men fled from the back of the old palace, heading north into the mountains under cover of darkness. The morning after that, Emperor Haile Selassie I, conquering Lion of Judah, King of Kings, descendant of Solomon, returned to Addis Ababa by plane. Word of his arrival spread like wildfire, and a dancing, ululating crowd lined the road as his motorcade went by. Throngs took to the street, arms linked, hopping in unison, springs in their feet, chanting his name long after he passed. Among them were Gibru, W.W. Gonad, and Almaz. She reported that His Majesty's face had been full of love for his people, appreciation for their loyalty.
"I saw him as clearly as I see you standing there," she said.
"I swear he had tears in his eyes. God strike me down if I am lying."
The university students who had marched through the streets a few days before were nowhere to be seen. The mood in the city was celebratory. Shops were open. Taxis of both the horse-drawn and petrol variety were out with a vengeance. The sun was shining, and it was a beautiful day in Addis Ababa. In our bungalow, the mood was somber. I'd always thought of General Mebratu and Zamui as the good guys, my heroes. The Emperor was far from a bad guy, and the attempts of the coup leaders to make him one weren't convincing. Still, I wanted the general to succeed in what he'd started. The tide had turned, and the worst possible thing had happened. My heroes had become the bad guys, and one didn't dare say otherwise. Rosina and Genet suffered agonies waiting for news, knowing that whatever it was, it wouldn't be good. It sunk in for me that Zamui would probably never pick up his motorcycle again. Darwin would get no more letters from his friend. The bridge evenings with General Mebratu as the life of the party were almost certainly over. The Emperor offered a huge reward for the capture of General Mebratu and his brother. The night after the Emperor's return, there were gun battles in different neighborhoods as the last of the rebels were hunted down. I felt so sorry for the rank-and-file Imperial bodyguard men like the one I saw dragged away. His crime was to belong to the losing side, or perhaps even the wrong side. But all he'd done was follow orders. General Mebratu had determined his fate. I didn't know what to think about our general anymore. The man we knew and admired seemed unrelated to the notorious and now hunted rebel who led the failed coup. Every time I